Having spent the night with only one brief catnap, Leto was awake when Maneo emerged from the guest house at dawn. The royal cart had been parked almost in the center of a three-sided courtyard. The cart's cover had been set on one way opaque, concealing its occupant, and was tightly sealed against moisture. Leto could hear the faint stirring of the fans which pulsed his air through a drying cycle. Maneo's feet scratched on the courtyard's cobbles as he approached the cart. Dawnlight edged the guest house roof with orange above the major domo. Leto opened the cart's cover as Maneo stopped in front of him. There was a yeasting dirt smell to the air, and the accumulation of moisture in the breeze was painful. "We should arrive at Tuono about noon," Maneo said. "I wish you'd let me bring in thopters to guard the sky."
"I do not want thopters," Leto said. "We can go down to Tuono on suspensers and ropes."
Leto marveled at the plastic images in this brief exchange. Maneo had never liked peregrinations. His youth as a rebel had left him with suspicions of everything he could not see or label. He remained a mass of latent judgments.
"You know I don't want thopters for transport," Maneo said. "I want them to guard—"
"Yes, Maneo."
Maneo looked past Leto at the opened end of the courtyard which overlooked the river canyon. Dawnlight was frosting the mist which arose from the depths. He thought of how far down that canyon dropped, a body twisting, twisting as it fell. Maneo had found himself unable to go to the canyon's lip last night and peer down into it. The drop was such a temptation. With that insightful power which filled Maneo with such awe, Leto said,
"There's a lesson in every temptation, Maneo."
Speechless, Maneo turned to stare directly into Leto's eyes.
"See the lesson in my life, Maneo."
"Lord."
It was only a whisper.
"They tempt me first with evil, then with good. Each temptation is fashioned with exquisite attention to my susceptibilities. Tell me, Maneo, if I choose the good, does that make me good?"
"Of course it does, Lord."
"Perhaps you will never lose the habit of judgment," Leto said.
Maneo looked away from him once more and stared at the chasm's edge. Leto rolled his body to look where Maneo looked. Dwarf pines had been cultured along the lip of the canyon. There were hanging dewdrops on the damp needles, each of them sending a promise of pain to Leto. He longed to close the cart's cover, but there was an immediacy in those jewels which attracted his memories even while they repelled his body. The opposed synchrony threatened to fill him with turmoil.
"I just don't like going around on foot," Maneo said. "It was the Fremen way," Leto said.
Maneo sighed.
"The others will be ready in a few minutes. Hui was breakfasting when I came out."
Leto did not respond. His thoughts were lost in memories of night, the one just past, and the millennial others which crowded his pasts. Clouds and stars, the rains and the open blackness pocked with glittering flakes from a shredded cosmos, a universe of nights, extravagant with them as he had been with his heartbeats. Maneo suddenly demanded,
"Where are your guards?" "I sent them to eat. I don't like them leaving you unguarded."
The crystal sound of Maneo's voice rang in Leto's memories, speaking things not cast in words. Maneo feared a universe where there was no god emperor. He would rather die than see such a universe.
"What will happen today?" Maneo demanded.
It was a question directed not to the god emperor, but to the prophet.
"A seed blown on the wind could be tomorrow's willow tree," Leto said. "You know our future. Why won't you share it?"
Maneo was close to hysteria, refusing anything his immediate senses did not report. Leto turned to glare at the majordomo, a gaze so obviously filled with pent-up emotions that Maneo recoiled from it.
"Take charge of your own existence, Maneo!"
Maneo took a deep, trembling breath.
"Lord, I meant no offense. I sought only—" "Look upward, Maneo!"
Involuntarily, Maneo obeyed, peering into the cloudless sky where morning light was increasing.
"What is it, Lord?" "There's no reassuring ceiling over you, Maneo. Only an open sky full of changes. Welcome it. Every sense you possess is an instrument for reacting to change. Does that tell you nothing?"
"Lord, I only came out to inquire when you would be ready to proceed."
"Maneo, I beg you to be truthful with me."
"I am truthful, Lord."
"But if you live in bad faith, lies will appear to you like the truth."
"Lord, if I lie, then I do not know it."
"That has the ring of truth, but I know what you dread and will not speak."
Maneo began to tremble. The God Emperor was in the most terrible of moods, a deep threat in every word.
"You dread the imperialism of consciousness," Leto said, "and you are right to fear it. Send Hui out here immediately."
Maneo whirled and fled back into the guest house. It was as though his entrance stirred up an insect colony. Within seconds, fish speakers emerged and spread around the royal cart. Courtiers peered from the guest house windows or came out and stood under deep eaves, afraid to approach him. In contrast to this excitement, Hui emerged presently from the wide central doorway and strode out of the shadows, moving slowly toward Leto, her chin up, her gaze seeking his face. Leto felt himself becoming calm as he looked at her. She wore a golden gown he had not seen before. It had been piped with silver and jade at the neck and the cuffs of its long sleeves. The hem, almost dragging on the ground, had heavy green braid to outline deep red crenellations. Hui smiled as she stopped in front of him.
"Good morning, love," she spoke softly. "What have you done to get poor Maneo so upset?"
Soothed by her presence and her voice, he smiled.
"I did what I always hoped to do. I produced an effect."
"You certainly did. He told the fish speakers you were in an angry and terrifying mood. Are you terrifying, love?"
"Only to those who refuse to live by their own strengths."
"Ah, yes."
She pirouetted for him then, displaying her new gown.
"Do you like it? Your fish speakers gave it to me. They decorated it themselves."
"My love," he said, a warning note in his voice, "decoration! That is how you prepare the sacrifice."
She came up to the edge of the cart and leaned on it just below his face, a mock solemn expression on her lips.
"Will they sacrifice me, then?"
"Some of them would like to."
"But you will not permit it."
"Our fates are joined," he said.
"Then I shall not fear."
She reached up and touched one of his silver-skinned hands, but jerked away as his fingers began to tremble.
"Forgive me, love. I forget that we are joined in soul and not in flesh," she said.
The sand trout skin still shuddered from Hui's touch.
"Moisture in the air makes me overly sensitive," he said.
Slowly the shuddering subsided.
"I refuse to regret what cannot be," she whispered.
"Be strong, Hui, for your soul is mine."
She turned at a sound from the guest house.
"Maneo returns," she said. "Please, love, do not frighten him."
"Is Maneo your friend, too?"
"We are friends of the stomach. We both like yogurt."
Leto was still chuckling when Maneo stopped beside Hui. Maneo ventured a smile, casting a puzzled glance at Hui. There was gratitude in the majordomo's manner, and some of the subservience he was accustomed to show to Leto he now directed at Hui.
"Is it well with you, Lady Hui?"
"It is well with me," Leto said.
"In the time of the stomach, friendships of the stomach are to be nurtured and cultivated. Let us be on our way, Maneo. Tuono awaits."
Maneo turned and shouted orders to the fish speakers and courtiers. Leto grinned at Hui.
"Do I not play the impatient bridegroom with a certain style?"
She leaped lightly up to the bed of his cart, her skirt gathered in one hand. He unfolded her seat. Only when she was seated, her eyes level with Leto's, did she respond, and then it was in a voice pitched for his ears alone.
"Love of my soul, I have captured another of your secrets."
"Release it from your lips,"
he said, joking in this new intimacy between them.
"You seldom need words," she said. "You speak directly to the senses with your own life."
A shudder flexed its way through the length of his body. It was a moment before he could speak, and then it was in a voice she had to strain to hear above the hubbub of the assembling cortege.
"Between the superhuman and the inhuman," he said, "I have had little space in which to be human. I thank you, gentle and lovely Hui, for this little space. In all of my universe, I have seen no law of nature, unchanging and inexorable. This universe presents only changing relationships, which are sometimes seen as laws by short-lived awareness. These fleshly sensoria, which we call self, are ephemera, withering in the blaze of infinity, fleetingly aware of temporary conditions which confine our activities and change as our activities change. If you must label the absolute, use its proper name, temporary."
The Stolen Journals. Nayla was the first to glimpse the approaching cortege. Perspiring heavily in the midday heat, she stood near one of the rock pillars which marked the edges of the royal road. A sudden flash of distant reflection caught her attention. She peered in that direction, squinting, realizing with a thrill of awareness that she saw Sundazzle on the cover of the God Emperor's cart.
"They come!" she called.
She felt hunger then. In their excitement and singleness of purpose, none of them had brought food. Only the Fremen had brought water, and that because
Fremen always carry water when they leave siege.
They did it by rote. Nayla touched one finger to the butt of the lasgun holstered at her hip. The bridge lay no more than 20 meters ahead of her, its fairy structure arching across the chasm like an alien fantasy, joining one barren surface to another.
"This is madness," she thought.
But the God Emperor had reinforced his command. He required his Nayla to obey Siona in all things. Siona's orders were explicit, leaving no way for evasions. And Nayla had no way here to query her God Emperor. Siona had said,
"When his cart is in the middle of the bridge, then." But why?
They had been standing well away from the others in the chill dawn atop the barrier wall, Nayla feeling precariously isolated here, remote and vulnerable. Siona's grim features, her low, intense voice, could not be denied.
"Do you think you can harm God?" "I..."
Nayla could only shrug.
"You must obey me."
"I must," Nayla agreed. Nayla studied the approach of the distant cortege, noting the colors of the courtiers, the thick masses of blue marking her sisters of the fish speakers, the shiny surface of her lord's cart. It was another test, she decided. The God Emperor would know. He would know the devotion in his Nayla's heart. It was a test. The God Emperor's commands must be obeyed in all things. That was the earliest lesson of her fish speaker childhood. The God Emperor had said that Nayla must obey Siona. It was a test. What else could it be? She looked toward the four Fremen. They had been positioned by Duncan Idaho directly in the roadway and blocking part of the exit from this end of the bridge. They sat with their backs to her and looked out across the bridge, four brown-robed mounds. Nayla had heard Idaho's words to them.
"Do not leave this place. You must greet him from here. Stand when he nears you and bow low."
"Greet, yes."
Nayla nodded to herself. The three other fish speakers who had climbed the barrier wall with her had been sent to the center of the bridge. All they knew was what Siona had told them in Nayla's presence. They were to wait until the royal cart was only a few paces from them, then they were to turn and dance away from the cart, leading it and the procession toward the vantage point above Tuono.
"If I cut the bridge with my lasgun, those three will die," Nayla thought, "and all the others who come with our lord."
Nayla craned her neck to peer down into the gorge. She could not see the river from here, but she could hear its distant rumblings, a movement of rocks.
"They would all die." "Unless he performs a miracle."
That had to be it. Siona had set the stage for a holy miracle. What else could Siona intend now that she had been tested, now that she wore the uniform of Fish Speaker Command? Siona had given her oath to the God Emperor. She had been tested by God, the two of them alone in the Serir. Nayla turned only her eyes to the right, peering at the architects of this greeting. Siona and Idaho stood shoulder to shoulder in the roadway about 20 meters to Nayla's right. They were deep in conversation, looking at each other occasionally, nodding. Presently, Idaho touched Siona's arm, an oddly possessive gesture. He nodded once and strode off toward the bridge, stopping at the buttress corner directly in front of Nayla. He peered down, then crossed to the other near corner of the bridge. Again he peered downward, standing there for several minutes before returning to Siona. What a strange creature, that Gola, Nayla thought.